OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in at home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now you're welcome along. It's Monday Night Rugby. I'm looking forward to this, I have to say. I don't think we've had these two on together much at all. A roadshow or two, but then rarely just chewing the fat on the radio of an evening. Keith Wood, hello to you.
Hi, Joe. How are you getting on?
I'm very well. And Ronan O'Gara, hello to you.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
I saw via your Twitter this morning some of the O'Gara kids making their way to school. Were they sad to be going to school or thrilled to get out of the house?
Typical me, I was a little bit slow with the uptake. They were actually there last week as well, but I decided to post the photo this morning. It was, they were mixed emotions. I think my son was keen to get back to see his friends. My daughter isn't really enjoying it. But very strange putting on the masks, because for a kid, I don't know, have we not got the mask size right, but it kind of encompasses most of their face. And I suppose it was one thing you probably didn't expect to see in our lifetimes, well, unless you were going to the Far East. But it was a strange morning, and off they went. And these are the times we're in now over here.
Yeah, it was very strange to see the kids in masks. We haven't quite got to that stage over here.
Yeah, and I went shopping on Saturday, and it's the first time really, because for the U Express or the Supermarché, you don't need a mask. But we went to a surf shop for the first time really, because they're back open, and kids wanted to look at boogie boards. So you have to put on the mask, and they're particularly uncomfortable. Well, maybe it was the cheap one I had, but within a half an hour, digging into your ears, and you actually have kind of ailments there. But geez, the admiration now you have for these frontline staff is quite incredible when you consider this was probably 90 minutes max, and they're doing it, some of them, 14 hours a day. It's phenomenal.
Mm. Not to impinge on your privacy in any way, your daughter, I presume, has moved to a few different schools at this stage. That must be tough. Do you feel a little bit of guilt when you're looking at that and you're trying to say, cajole her and go to school and we could be moving again in a while?
Yeah, huge, huge guilt. Yeah, it's probably the biggest negative, the impact on your children. They say that they're very adaptable, but I remember my school days. I keep asking, what school would you be in Irish class? So it'd be there in fifth class. So I probably, in the most selfish of worlds, have another 2, potentially 3 years, because by second, third year, secondary school, they have to be, well, I think back in Ireland.
Right.
Because school in Ireland would be good, I think, you know. I just think you'd, as Woody talked off air just about his relationship with his father and with his family, it's something that I think is very important, that they go to a school that they'd like to go to, and not that they know much about it, and they have become, I suppose, very French, but it's just, even with this, I suppose, particularly bizarre period we're in now, time is flying, and once you're involved in rugby, you just get on that roller coaster, and it hasn't stopped only up to 3 months ago. Maybe I have too much reflection time now.
Yes. And what's the solution if in 2-3 years they have to be in school in Ireland and there's no job for you in Ireland?
Well, you got to find a job, Joe, don't you? So that could be anything. Woody's on the board, so we'll have plenty of offers for
you. I look after you, Rog. Don't worry. Yeah. I look after you.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just going to say there, Joe, it's funny because we're, this is a sports program. We talk about sports all the time, and we think of things that are important or not important. And I know the COVID thing is huge, but if you take that bit aside, you kind of forget that young parents have kids, have all those other things that have to happen as well, you know. And so you'd be getting criticism, Rog, or you'd be lauded for doing something well, but you still have to have a normal existence, and you're still trying to do everything that everybody else is doing at the same time. And sport is, it's kind of crazy that way, because we forget it, because you only ever see the time you're on the television, or you're playing a game, or you're leading a team or whatever. You know, you forget that the real world gets in the way too.
Yeah, it's so such a great point, because that's, some people think because you're on TV that you're not normal, or that's not a real person. But as you said, we have absolutely the exact same feelings. And the most important thing for Jess and I is to be good parents. But within that, then you're as competitive as you can be when you do your, if you want to call it a job, but a passion, which is rugby for me, and I earn a living out of it. But it's like kids have no idea what's involved, and you don't really want them to know either, because essentially you're just a mum and dad at the end of the day, and that's what guides every decision we make.
Yeah. Right, I'll get us back on track. It's not fair to press you. We didn't bring you on to talk about that. So, Keith, 2000, Munster, early impressions of a young O'Gara?
I thought he was too small. I thought he was beside Stringer, who was too small. I actually wasn't worried by Rog. Or for Rog, I was worried for Stringer. And the game was kind of rough and tumble at that stage. It's much cleaner now anyway. And you kind of worry about those guys. But we had Jeremy Staunton was in Munster as well at that stage. Killian Keane, who played 10, played centre. And so looking at some of the early training sessions, and I know Rog had played and had played in previous years, but looking at some of the training sessions, you'd say, God, is he going to be robust enough to be able to deal with any of this? And of course, he proved to be the most robust of the lot of us, you know, so he was able to take anything. But I didn't have doubts. You're just worried because you're looking at not a particularly big man. And those doubts disappear, not in training sessions. It's funny, some people train incredibly well and don't play that well, you know, but those doubts disappeared on clinch kicks. And this is a guy who was able to deliver on the big on a big stage. And so a lot of those early matches that we played in 99, I was kind of slightly taken aback by their quality, both at 9 and 10. I love playing with Stringer because he'd fling the ball at you, and if you called for it, it was your fault if you made a mess of it, you know, and he was very confident and very capable. I remember having like lots of conversations with Rog just to shout at me, get me out of the way, do whatever you want, you're the boss at 10, you know, and he did, he bossed 10. He was quiet, but every now and then the angry man that we got to see an awful lot more of later on in his career came out, which was, I think, when he got his absolute best.
Yeah. Now, I don't bring this up casually, even though it's 20 years ago. I know, Ronan, a terrible memory for you and a horrible experience. I'll bring you in a second. Keith, 2000 final against Northampton. Ronan's talked about it before, the missed kicks. What was your perspective on that day?
At the exact time, I wanted the kicks to go over. Like every fan, like every player. And when the game is over, and I can say this with great comfort, I didn't blame Rog. And I've heard people say afterwards, and I heard Rog say afterwards, that he blamed himself because that was his job to kick the kicks. I look at it a bit different, actually. I still feel that we should have scored tries, more tries that day than we did. We were not great. If everybody had played perfectly that day and Rog didn't miss four kicks, I think you could probably blame Rog. But we hadn't, and we were well off the mark. And that wasn't the reason that we lost. And I never felt that that was the reason that we lost. And it hurts sometimes when I listen to Rod kind of talk about missing those kicks and that it would have had an impact on him. Well, I don't know how much of a negative impact it had on him, but he had to deal with it for a long time afterwards. He took it as being part of his responsibility. For me, I think that's fine when you're 30 years of age. It's not fine when you're a young fella that's kind of really getting yourself onto the proper stage. So, I was annoyed we lost the game.
Sure.
But not once did it come into my mind to blame Rog.
Do I have it right, Ronan? Did you phone Keith that summer? I'm sure you were picking different people's brains. Was it that summer you phoned him?
Oh, gee, I have so much to say on this, Joe.
Okay, you lead off wherever you want then.
If I can talk. Yeah, because I've listened there, and it's such an interesting subject, and it's probably not the greatest day of my career, but the most important day of my career. And the messages received out of that day were the most important, because, you know, even now what jumps into my mind is you look at the Crusaders environment and they have a deeply caring environment. But I think Munster 2000 was exactly, there's just different language used nowadays, but in Munster in 2000, it was an unbelievably good environment, caring environment, brilliant culture, absolute massive work rate for the guy next to you, bodies on the line, all that really mattered. And that's why it cut so deep 20 years later, because it was the quality of men that, it's okay for me because I got a medal in 06 or 08, and I know these guys will feel they were part of it, but there's a massive dagger to my heart in the fact that Woody, Claw, Gallov, there's Halvey, there's a lot of guys, Ken O'Connell, a lot of old school guys that really, really matter to you, because I think we've a great forum in Ireland for looking back after the event with hindsight, and hindsight is a great selector, as they say, and that. But at the time, like, the guy who shaped me in the early days was Woody, because mentally, whatever it was, I just felt that he was just way superior to other people. And don't forget that this is a time, and I have to repeat it again, there was 200 people at Munster Leinster Games. So it's alien to a lot of people, but like in terms of sports science, in terms of resilience, in terms of coming back from setbacks, who do you go to? And I was very lucky to have, you know what I mean? For me, this is the guy with Johnson, with all of his teammates, Dawson, Tom Smith, all these guys in 97 that won a mythical series, Jenkins, Gus Scott in South Africa. So, like, this is as good as it gets, because you're playing with a guy that has won a Lions series over there. And I think nowadays we have The Last Dance and new stuff like that. But, like, living with the Lions was the greatest Christmas present you could ever get. And you just watch every Christmas morning. But for me, that 2000 final, and Woody talked about there that I showed in big games my capacity to nail big kicks, but I don't think Woody saw it, and that he just talking me there. But he saw it afterwards as a result of the work he put into me. And I rang him several times when literally it meant so much to you, because you're a young guy, and maybe my aids or my outlets for dealing with pressure probably weren't where they needed to be in terms of what outlets or what crutches do you use to help yourself, because it's okay not to be okay and you've got to talk and stuff. But I thought basically when you took a kick a goal that the whole of the country would stop and watch it. But as we know, that doesn't happen. But that was kind of how press players and playing for Munster and the mythical teams that were there over the years, that you felt that this was such an important position. And it is a great position, but sometimes you put yourself under unnecessary pressure. So when things didn't go right, it was Woody who'd have to bear the brunt of. And it wasn't me giving up, but I'll always remember it was basically, you can, and it's a subject that still applies to this day, and it's a subject that I think real kickers can only comprehend. Pressure will hit maybe once a season. It mightn't hit at all. But the words, I can repeat them to every young boy and girl out there, and it applies to GA, soccer, whatever it is as well. He just goes, unless you have a technique that is bulletproof, it'll come back to bite you. You might get away with it in qualifying and semi-final, but it'll catch you. And it's brilliant words. You can sweep it under the carpet, what happened in Twickenham, or you can actually address this, look in the mirror, take it on. And you know, for years I was mad for, I'm only looking back now, about for goal setting and for kicks and the left 15 in the middle of the post on the right bridge of the 15, how many out of five today, how many out of five Tuesday, how many out of five on Wednesday, and you multiply that by kind of your zone with six kicks, so you kind of had a kind of a routine of 30 kicks per session. But I had to do that to build up the reps to get that, to get the confidence. And you were going to get the confidence by nailing it in big occasions. And then experience, confidence becomes being able to do something better, which is the same task the next time.
Hmm. Keith, what's your memory of it, the phone call and the advice that you gave and why you gave that advice?
Well, I think the phone call, the big one we had, I think, was 2002. It was after we toured New Zealand, and Adidas had brought out a ball. It was called the Pig. It was a yellow ball. And it was pretty much an impossible ball to kick. It wasn't like...
No, that's balls. Absolute. But that's, I think... It was more impossible potentially because there was sheets of ice on it because it was so cold, but it still doesn't go like a dead duck if you don't kick it right.
No. I look. It was funny because there was humorous things over it because I kept catching the ball. I kept hoofing the ball. I always thought if you had a pure kick, you were in all sorts of trouble.
I think if memory serves me correct, did you knock out a 60-meter spiral with it? I think you did.
I knocked out a 60-meter kick with it. I don't think it qualifies okay. as a spiral. Okay. We'd like it, but no. But I remember thinking back, everybody complained about it. It wasn't just you, Rog. And Andrew Mertens hated the bloody thing. And he had a huge fight with the All Black management about actually playing with it. But it's amazing when feeling a little bit vulnerable, how things that are taken outside of your control can really impact on you. And I think you were on holiday somewhere. You gave me a phone call from the beach, and you were just low.
No, it was unbelievable. I can remember it so perfectly. It was Greece, 2002, and it was the fact basically we had two chances to beat New Zealand away from home, and that was unheard of, obviously, going back 18 years. But it was that made it extra disappointing, and then it was kind of you have to wait 2.5 months to your next game, Joe, and it's so difficult with that because you just realize what a glorious opportunity I've had, how many teammates have I left down, and also when is this going to get right, when is it going to happen to me on a big stage, and you're just like, oh, it's just goal kicking, which is, you just have to get it right if you want to be a great kicker.
And what was going wrong? If you take 2000, if you take 2002 New Zealand, that's a still
my
a short enough.
I don't think my technique was bulletproof, Joe. I hadn't worked it out. And over the years, then I kind of, because, you know what I mean, you have a few kicking coaches coming on the scene, a little bit of input or potential sticking their nose in by other coaches that maybe you don't need, but you're very, very curious. I see it with Paul Carrington. I very much associate with that in terms of there was days there that I was getting kicks and my mind was kind of warped in the fact that if it wasn't the middle, I was a bit sour with myself and pissed off and kind of like after a while, it was kind of only with a bit of maturity or like, that's the wrong attitude you have, but you kind of play such games and training with yourself that the posts are massive. How can you miss? It's because you've kind of 3 meters here, 3 meters left, and you visualize the hoop, and you just want to kick the ball through there, and it's got to be top pocket contact, and you start talking language to yourself, and you start talking to your kicking coach. But after a number of years, I realized basically for me, it's all about timing and just trusting my timing, get my rhythm and my timing. And that's what I went back to. And then, I suppose having the capacity to know that my technique was good, that there was a lot of work gone into it, and that I could mentally stand up to the challenge. And I think once mentally you could stand up to it, hopefully skill set and structure you should be good at too.
Rog, you mentioned a couple of words there. One was trust and the other was the pressure, as if you had the whole of the country watching you kick. I remember in some of the first matches we played together, if you had a conversion from the touchline, I felt guaranteed that's going over. That's going over. There was no doubt that that was going over. If you had a kick in the middle of the field at the start, that was far more pressured for you. Did you feel that? That's what it felt like for me. I said, I worry about that one now, not the one from the touchline.
No, because the short answer to that too is that for me, right, a kick right in front of the post, Woody, because I'm a right footer, okay? If it's bang in front of the black dot, I'm pretty sure I have it. If it's a meter to the right, it puts your angle out completely. And you might say, what are you talking about? But it actually, because you have to kind of, you come back on a 90 degrees, but if it's a 1 meter right, I know you're kind of saying, well, you surely only have to adjust by 1 meter, but like you have done that kick so many times in training from middle of the posts, 40 meters in front on the 10-yard line, that you just know you knock it over in your sleep. But if it's a 2 or 3 meters or 5 meters, but all the commentators will go, O'Gara's straight in front of the post, but it's actually not the same kick at all.
Yes.
At all.
Well, that's
very, very different.
That's intriguing. But the one from the touchline, you're talking about overthinking. But part of the overthinking for me would be, well, that's a really, really tough kick. And because it's tough, people probably don't expect him to put it over. He's guaranteed to bang it over.
And this may be of interest to the younger listeners. Every kick is the same. And you say, okay, explain that to me. So essentially, every kick, so in front of the posts, is exactly the same from the touchline. All it comes into is your angle and your setup. So I think younger kids would struggle because of the distance element potentially, if they're whatever, 12 or younger. But like from the touchline or from in the middle of the post on the 22, the only thing that's playing games with you is your head. All you have to do is kind of, you have to know how the angle works. And once you understand how the angle works, you basically just staying tall and you're kicking through the ball. So it's the exact same as you know, in golf when you have to hit a fairway. If a fairway is kind of, but all the ball is that size. So a 10-meter fairway is massive, but some people are kind of looking for a 40-meter fairway. So the ball doesn't deviate. Once you nail it, you nail it.
But did you feel less pressure on the sideline and therefore it freed you up to kick better?
I would say probably at the start, Joe, yeah, because it's kind of a freebie. It's a gimme nearly because they're not expected. You know, but like the kicks for real kickers where they're judged on, essentially you can't miss between the 15s. So on that arc between the 15 to the 10-yard line, it's just non-negotiable.
And from a mindset point of view, things like I've missed my first kick or my first two kicks, parking that and kicking well for the rest of the game, all the things that go on in your head, at what point did you reach a standard where you thought you were, to use your phrase, pretty close to bulletproof?
Well, actually, interesting that you said, I think statistically, I missed my first kick in a lot of games. A school friend of mine, Connor Howell, a good friend of mine, actually, who was very interested in my career and remains a great friend. Obviously, he kind of just sent me some data someday, kind of going, this may be of interest to you. And it was very interesting in the fact that because I'm in the moment and I'm just thinking next training section, next kicking session, next game. But he was saying, maybe you're biting off a little bit too much and having a 53-meter kick with your first kick at the goal. Why don't you just probably maybe have a look at this data and say, well, if you want to get it to the next level, this is what you do. And it was very interesting. The fact was, it's kind of because had I struggled with maybe transferring from finishing routine of the warm-up into game and taking it for granted that, okay, this is goal, but it was something that was very helpful to me to improve. But that, like, that's the beauty of it, Joe. Like, you're not dealing with a machine or a robot. It's every kick is kind of, my mantra was, every kick is your first kick, and get into routine mode.
Raj, I ended up with some of the lineouts getting caught in mats, saying, okay, I've lost the first lineout, then I win one. God, I'm only at 50%.
Yeah.
And you can get yourself into just the most ludicrous place. And at that stage, we'd have maybe 20 lineouts in a match. So if you lost 5, which would be unconscionable now, you'd still be at 75%, which would be a pretty decent rate. Now, not the way lineouts are gone now. But and you get that element of, where do you go? And are you just happy for winning the ball? And then are you happy for winning the ball in the right place for the team? Because actually, that is infinitely more important than you just winning the lineup ball.
And it still applies in this day and age. I can guarantee you, if I sit down with you with Opta or whatever stats you go through, some of them, you wonder, like, so exactly, what does winning a lineout qualify as? So it's essentially, you could tap it back at two and it go along the ground and it could trickle into touch. So, like, I think most importantly, that's why they're so dangerous and so powerful in the same sentence. It's that you got to absolutely know as a coach how to use them, because they can be very, very misleading at times. And then I think some players go about their duty or their task is to actually build up stats, which became infuriating at times in my Irish and Munster career, that you had guys that had a big work rate, but like literally were going gathering stats as opposed to how can I get this team into a better place, or how can I impact more positively on the team, as opposed to going around getting the stats for that look good in the Monday morning. It's a really double-edged sword.
Given your friends' statistics about your first kick, did you ever get to a point where you tried to, where possible, make your first kick an easy kick?
No, because I, as we've discussed, I suppose, on the television plenty of times, Joe, that decision was taken from me, which was great.
Sure.
I was blessed to play with the best of the leaders in the world game, and I had very, they were very good, I suppose, after, you see, the public are people get to see you on a Saturday for 180 minutes, while your teammates get 8 hours a day, which are Monday to Friday, so they're very, very good at reading your cues or how you're feeling, and I think that's what makes the game of rugby so interesting in the provinces and with the national team, that there are such really good relationships in terms of being able to read how this guy is thinking. So with the guys that were my captains, it was essentially their decision, and that's the way it should be.
I think that's what captaincy is, really. You're supposed to know the players. You know, it takes her. I remember, and we're talking about, you're saying clinch games that I never played with you doing, but coming off the bench in 2001 against England, your first thing was to kick a 45-metre goal from directly in front of the post, maybe a metre to the right, I don't know. And I remember you saying, I don't know, I'm not fully warm. I said, you're kicking it, you're fine.
Yeah, and exactly.
But I don't know if you remember this, and that's 2001. I don't know what age you were in 2001, 22 or 3, were you?
Yeah, yeah.
24 maybe. And but you were already a leader at that stage, because you were 10. You have to be the guy who pulls the strings all that week, because we were under huge pressure that week. It was a big, big game for us. We hadn't beaten England in 7 years. The guys who stood up in that were both David Humphreys, and yourself stood up that week. I don't even know if you realised you were. So for me, the idea of giving you the ball and you're only just on the field didn't even cross my mind. I said, there's no doubt. This is a guy who actually stood up to the plate that week. And for me, that was a bigger movement for you becoming the player that you were afterwards, because it wasn't anything to do with you. It was just, actually, yeah, he's going to do that, because that was a presumption for me that ball was going over.
Hmm. So to kind of knit a few things together then, you're on the scene, there's the Northampton game, there's 0-2 when you're in Greece and you're phoning Keith, there's been...
I'm playing, so unfortunately Woody goes back, you know, so that's a big chunk of professionalism taken out of Munster.
Sure.
But I still have the relationship obviously established at that stage, and we're playing on the national team, but we were aware that we could only get him for a year, but everyone wanted him for a year. But like that was the deal, you know. But it still gave me incredible appetite to go on that 0-1 tour, you know. So we go on a Lions tour as well to Australia, which was brilliant for me, because it was essentially, that was the key probably point. So you have 2,000 defeat, you have 2001 when you're rooming with. It goes from Delalio to Martin Johnson to Johnny Wilkinson to Jason Robinson to who essentially the English team that win the World Cup in 2003.
Yeah. So was Dave Alred, was Dave Alred on that line?
Yes, still? The kicking coach. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I worked most of my career with Dave, and I worked with Mark Tainton, who's now the CEO of Bristol Rugby, and they were the two guys I used.
Did your technique change much?
I tried everything. I became a power kicker, Joe. I became switch on the obliques and the core and fire up the glutes and the quads, all kinds of different things. They're fascinating because they're just different ways of coaching and applying it. But I think, you know, there's the, obviously the Dave Alred's project was Johnny Wilkinson, and the benefit Johnny had over I was the fact he was in the same country. My learning at that stage was by email, which didn't work because I needed an eye on me. Recording with a basic video just wasn't where my head was at, or I felt second best to Johnny if that's how it is, you know what I mean? Well, he has him on his pitch in Newcastle. Mm. I'm here in Musgrave Park, and I get him once every 2 weeks through Adidas. But like, that's not good enough, you know? And so I was kind of like, well, I need to get a kicking coach full time. And Mark Tainton came in, but Mark was different because Dave was kind of into the, you know, I think he studies flight dynamics, and he's very, very into the analytical side of it in terms of, you know, how he goes through it. But sometimes kicking doesn't need to be complicated, and it took me a while to realize that. And I kind of was really lucky in the fact that I got Martin, and every kind of Wednesday was my banker session for getting reps in. We kept the process very simple, but because of being curious, and you Johnny doing this and you Dan doing that, it was, well, I need to be having a look at this because I feel I'm missing out here.
Yes.
And that's how the human mind works.
To extend the golfer analogy and the Harrington analogy in particular, paralysis by analysis is an issue in golf. You can lose your technique.
Yeah, and also then Padraig came into Irish camp. I think it might have been around, it was actually the infamous Enfield camp, I think, but no one talks about the speech the day before that Padraig gave. And for me, it blew my mind away because he was talking about the right side of the brain and the left side of the brain. As a student of the game, you forget these kind of things and how fascinating it is when you hear someone applying that, and it just triggered all kinds of things in my head. And listening to that, I was like, wow, this is so interesting, this so resonates. But I had done so much at that stage in my own that I was kind of able to say, yeah, that's I need that, I don't need that. But I'm after losing my thought there in terms of how did I tie that in with the
I'm just you could get lost in you know, Dave Alred's technique and
yes, exactly. I had to decide essentially, as I said, that was kind of how I ended up as a timing kicker. Yeah, so everything was based on kind of feel and timing in terms of like just getting the approach, slow it down. The great thing too that people forget is adrenaline. Adrenaline is something that doesn't arrive Monday to Friday. But for young kickers, basically, like if your range on game day is 50, you should practice around 40 meters.
Mm.
So don't ever go into that kind of push it, force it, chop the technique range. Just everything is in timing and follow through and visualization and getting your process right. So that's what I ended up believing in, and it worked really well for me. I suppose after a few formative years when you tried a lot of different approaches and techniques.
And is timing kicking a popular one, a prevalent one? Is that the default kicking?
There are so many different ones because you look at the South Africans, you look at Pollard or Steyn, they belt the ball. They drive through it kind of, and they're all educated on a torpedo kick in terms of kicking the point of the ball and just kicking straight through it, while a lot of the Northern Hemisphere kickers would be kind of, I suppose, the ball would be a lot more upright in terms of, you know, Farrell, Ford, Sexton, myself, Wilkinson, kickers like that. Like off the sand, you Jenkins, who never missed, Halfpenny is more a mix between kind of a South African and I suppose his mentor Neil Jenkins style. Dan Carter is different because he's kind of around the house and he's very peculiar to himself.
Mm. Yeah, it is fascinating. Keith, I do remember when we had a chat, it's a couple of years ago now, and you were talking about line out throwing, and you had a little mantra that you would say to yourself on a pitch when confidence was lower and doubt, and it was something good's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I've used it myself a few times, just a little message to yourself. So you would never have struck, and I think it's true for Ronan as well, you would never struck us as someone who had confidence issues to any great degree ever.
Of course I had. Like absolutely every, and I was very confident. And I believed in what I was able to do. I'm really interested to hear some of Roger's stuff in terms of technique. I got a bad injury the week after the first time I sat on the bench for Ireland. I was 20 years of age and I had a shoulder operation that didn't really work. And I think if that happened now, there's no way I'd have played the first two or three years of my rugby career. You know, I may never have played, and that's kind of, you know, how do you deal with those up? But I had to try and build a technique, strangely, that didn't hurt. Because if it didn't hurt, and I got a pure flight and a pure throw, I didn't stop at the end. That was the big thing. If I stopped my throw at all, it could go anywhere. And there is so many times in my career where you're standing up and you're feeling very confident and you go to throw it. It hurts. You haven't done something exactly right. So I totally concur with Rog with the idea of getting a type of technique that flows. And for me, I had a flaw. And if I threw with the flaw, which was pushing my right hand out, if I threw with that, it really hurt. And I threw very badly. And like that doesn't excuse anything else. But I couldn't. So the amount of practice I could do afterwards was limited. So I couldn't do the Wednesday session where you would throw 100 balls. If I did that, I wouldn't have played on the Saturday. That was the nature of the injury I had. So for me, it was visualization and trying to get that pure technique, that pure throw, that kind of flow of a throw that you could get. But there's days when you're lost. I mean, playing against Australia for me with John Eales in the second row, jumping on his own, and two pods at the front of the last. Johnny Eales could jump almost to the full height of a pod lift on his own. So you know where to throw the ball, and that's when you're exposed. That's the pressure. As Rog said, there's adrenaline on a Saturday, but there's also real, real pressure when you have a big match and you're trying to thread a needle from about 10 yards. And we had a psychologist at one stage, and I didn't like the psychologist. I thought he was very defeatist an awful lot, but he had one little thing, and his thing was get a mantra, get something that when you're under huge pressure that you can fully center yourself and relax and throw, you know, in as much control as you could possibly be. And that dug me out of the rest of my career, actually, because there was times in at a period of time, the World Cup in 99, when I was just in the horrors. You know, the last place I wanted to be was to pick up a ball and throw it into the lineout. And we played Australia in the World Cup in 99. And I lost four lineouts. And it made me the best lineout performance I ever had in my life. And I lost four lineouts. I could have lost 14. They were an inch away from everything. And even though we were winning the lineout, the panic that was almost setting in, and like that, the changing point for me, I forced myself to build a mantra so that I'd actually be able to work a little bit better.
Mm. That's it. It's reminiscent of Oisin McConville, who won the All-Ireland with Armagh. If you watch it back, he was a free taker. And if he missed a free, he'd pick up a piece of grass and it went over his shoulder and done. I'm not thinking about it anymore. But I don't know how you can fully not think. You know, kicker misses one left, next one he's liable to push it right. You do a certain throw, you're liable to compensate next time around.
Well, you are, but that's where you have to be strong enough. So what you would say, I would have a very high level of confidence. What I would believe I have was the ability to say, that was done, let's move on to the next thing. That does not impact on the next thing that I do. And that was most important for me.
Do you want to come in on that, Rog? Park and the misses and confidence.
Yeah.
Where were you in the confidence spectrum?
Oh, geez, I've experienced every possible emotion. I think that's probably what leads me into this. I think there's potentially four different sections in this topic for me. So there's kicking with confidence. There's kicking when you're not in confidence. There's kind of the why am I missing? And then there is the absolute rock bottom. So essentially, right, you're for goal kicking, it can be the absolutely easiest subject in the world. The following day, your approach, everything in your process feels exactly the same, and the ball isn't going where you want it, and you just go, why?
And what's the answer to that?
Why? I don't have it. If I had it, I would have never missed. And then there's comes with you where you have to fight the demons on days. And Woody goes to me, because I can remember after 90-odd caps, I lost my confidence. And it's a horrible, horrible position to be in, because it's like literally trying to kick, or, for example, the example I would give would be kind of, it's like trying to drive on a motorway with the handbrake on. It's that has that much of an impact, and you might think you're exaggerating there, but like kicking, the human mind is the most fascinating subject, obviously, and whoever can get nail master this subject will have an unbelievable kicking career, because it's with now the amount of training time I suppose you can devote to it.
Yeah.
The percentages, even with the pressure, will always get better, because pitches are getting better, stadiums, the wind is having less of an impact. But like, wow, the impact for me as an individual when you were like, some days you just knew I can't miss.
Yeah. I presume there were days where you were low on confidence and you managed to kick quite well.
Well, exactly. And that's something that you learn from players that are more experienced than you and better than you, and the fact that they have passed that on to you. So basically, like, goal kicking is like, it's a single, it's not related to the game. So you have to compartmentalize it completely. You got your own game, and then you got to have your goal kicking game. So that was important. You learned that at a young age, just to completely separate the two of them, because you could be flying in your goal kick and you could be having a shocker on the pitch, or vice versa. But what the key is basically to be accepted, be a leader, as Woody talks, you got to be performing on both. And it does get to a stage where I have seen so many times with packs of forwards in red and green and red for the Lions, where if teams are 2 points down or 6 points down in the final 10 minutes, if they've got a guy they believe in as a kicker in 10, you watch them shift their ass. They will pull out all the stops for you. But I've seen plenty of other examples when different stages of games where there's a little bit of fucking, will he get this one or not? Boys up front will down tools. And this is going back 15 years, you know, because it's a potentially different mindset, but it is so, so important. If you sign up to do a job, you got to make sure you do what it says on the tin. And that was the great thing about Neil Jenkins. I think I remember I toured with him in 2001 in the Lions tour, and he literally asked Woody, like, he got picked on the bench for the last test. And I kind of looked at Graham Henry in disbelief going, well, this guy can barely walk. And I said, literally, a knee was like the size of a soccer ball, completely swollen. But he just said to me, and I completely agree with Graham Henry. No, he just said, if the field goal 45 meters out, I want him to kick it. And I just said, yeah, you can't argue with that. You're right.
In 97 tour, if you asked me, and I said this to you too, I only watched all those games about 2 months ago for the first time. You know, looking at every little part of it, I would have sworn on my house that Neil Jenkins did not miss a kick, but he missed a few kicks.
He did,
but I would have sworn he didn't, because my belief was that I actually ran back to the halfway line every time we got a penalty, and there is that sense of trust that we had in him, you know. So,
yeah,
but it's exactly the same too when you look at Johnny Wilkinson. Everyone thinks he never missed a kick, but if you go through, he's missed plenty of kicks. And his kicking out of hand is a little bit mixed as well, but become perception versus reality, and it goes back to stats a little bit. But, you know, in fairness to him, when you think of kicking, he's the first guy you think of, and that's rightly, I suppose, the honour that he holds in the kicking game world.
Yeah. If there was a flaw in your kick, Rog, like some golfers fight a hook or some fight a slice, wait, what was the thing you were always fighting in your kicking, or did it change over the years?
I think it changed a bit. I was constantly evolving and trying to go with it in terms of just what I learned basically from Woody's words early on with bulletproof. I always associated with like, how have you less margin of error to mess this, not to mess this up, but you know, my routine, my walking exactly should be perfect every single time. Then there aren't that many things that you have to get right, and it's not that difficult. So don't overestimate it either. But like, for that, you have to have, I think, a secure mindset starting off. And the younger you are, I think, and playing with a lot of legends, the more you can be filled with doubts if you miss.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, there was times over the career, the early stages, where you're kind of literally, maybe for the good of this team, I should hand over the tee. That's what I was thinking deep down.
Right.
But then if someone took the tee, by God, Joe, I was like, oh my God, this is like, oh God, imagine your life like that. But they would be, because I can, that's how you'd honestly feel. And I think that's what was so great about playing Munster and Ireland at the time. That's how we felt, that you could have those real discussions.
Mm.
Rog, if there was any chance or hope at one stage in my career where we could get another player on the field to throw the ball into the line-out, I'd have taken it in a heartbeat, because I love the game and I love playing the game. And the one part I hated was part of my bloody job.
Yeah, but I think also too, it's probably kicking, I think, has stayed pretty consistently in terms of the last 100 years in rugby union. The advances in the line-out and in throwing has just absolutely been scary, where you look at games even from 2000 to the quality of lift, the quality of throw, to actually what's involved in the creation of a lineup to where the game is now. I just think it looks nearly like a different game. That's just me, but it's not my area of expertise. But I just think it's you look at lift and top of the jump. There was very little of that in our language around 2000. But I think at least with kicking, you kind of, it has stayed quite consistent in terms of what is expected.
Yeah. We no coaching for lineouts ever. No. The only person who coached me the lineouts, strangely, was Ian McGeachan, a centre on the lines in 97. And it was to do with a bit of security. I'd had a couple of operations in the 6 weeks before we went on tour. And it was to have the stability to have the ball resting at the back before I threw it. And he said, look, you're putting yourself under pressure with it. And it was really interesting. So between him and the fitness guy, just to get that stability in it. But that was the only coaching I actually got in throwing in my whole career. So that's totally changed now. There are line-out coaches all over.
Well, exactly. And the fact that you're saying, you know what I mean? You're essentially learning on a Lions tour, which nowadays just, you know, these guys are at the peak of their powers when they're performing at any level in the Lions tour, let alone for a minute. But like, to think the difference in mindset for you, you're the starting hooker on the test team and you're actually essentially breaking down your throw on a tour by a guy who played centre. But it's fascinating, but that was where we were at the time.
Yeah. In your brief time as a kicking coach, did you try and impart things about technique or mindset, or is a good kicking coach maybe as well off saying nothing?
Good question. I think the strongest or the area I would probably believe most in, Joe, would be kind of seeing your kick over before you actually kick it. So visualization, that for me was huge. So basically you can, you know, imagine the piece of ball on the string and you see it exactly over the top of the blacktop at the top of its flight. And you essentially bring that back to your tee. You see, obviously, a lot of the modern kickers nowadays doing that with their eyes. But I think visualization is very, very powerful in the fact that, so you see it and you do it.
Mm.
Then you're not really creating much of a lottery in your mind.
Yeah. To round all this out, did you get to a point then, Ronan and or Keith, actually, because you're both weirdly involved in your own mini battles where you have to pull the trigger. Did you get to a point, Ronan, where you had a routine on the morning of a game, you had rituals, be it looking in a book or thinking about certain things, or could any morning of a game differ to any other morning?
No, I was a big fan of, I suppose, routine and rituals before a game, but over the long period of time I played, Joe, I kept, I suppose, changing and evolving those kind of game routines. Essentially, a lot for me as I got a little bit older, it was kind of either cold pool, ice bath, or cold shower. Then I like that. That's kind of my 5 minute period to get my mind right, and then it was basically try and forget about it till you get on the bus. And then, but I think it was, I've said this hundreds of times, but I was crippled with nerves for a large part of my sporting days.
Yeah, you shouldn't have been really towards that. That should have eased off a touch.
Well, Joe, I was just going to say that. So we've talked about all the battle that Rog had and the difficulties he had and the confidence and the technique. But that's only a very small part of his career. And I'm sure those doubts were there at the end of it. But at the end of the career, it was clinch kick after clinch kick, you know, not just kicking, by the way. So it was, and I always think players are good at their moment in time. And at that moment in time, Rog's ability to turn wingers and to kick into touch and to put teams under pressure, which doesn't happen as much anymore because the defensive setup in the back line is a bit more different. But that was all success. No, not all success, but like any percentage of success is success at that stage. And he had an awful lot of it. And that was something that was, but we spent all our time talking about maybe the more negative side of it.
No, I think it's probably just the, that, as you said, opened up the conversation. It's just that these are the feelings deep inside, which sometimes can get the better of us. I think it's important, exactly, that people chase their dreams, isn't it, in that regard? But you brought up an interesting point just about that, about it's something, and it's a hope of mine as a coach, for people to identify where the space is. Now it should be easier, Woody, to find the space behind the wingers. But I actually think, is the quality of kick there nowadays? Like a great hope of mine has to be to reinvent the spiral. The drilled spiral is undefendable, and also if this 50-22 rule comes in, also the fact if you've 13 in the front line, what does that mean? Like, are we seeing the space? Have I coached my players well enough to see the space? But can they execute it? So it's a lovely topic.
They're the lovely things in sport, that the more things change, the more things stay the same. But you can reinvent something from 10 years ago. I remember being asked by Munster to go down with the hookers to see if they could strike, because striking was becoming more, and they couldn't. And the reason they couldn't was all their training had gone away from that. They had no flexibility in their hips. It was going to take about a year or 18 months to get that flexibility back to be able to strike cleanly again. So, like, things get forgotten in the game, and actually an awful lot of the innovation is remembering things that really worked well in the past.
And I think that's where England maybe have an advantage at the minute. I think they've put a massive emphasis on their kicking game, which their kicking game enables them to probably be camped in the opposition's part of the pitch, which they have no problem giving away lineouts in the opposition half. All of a sudden, they absolutely ramp up their line speed, put insane pressure on them and create an error, then scrum attack to England. But you look at, like, you have the amount of kickers they have between Ford, Farrell, Slade and Daly. Like, kicking mightn't be the right term, but pushing the ball through into a zone that you either have to run out or you have to kick it out at a poor angle. But it's something I think now that's going to become really topical again, this kicking game.
Yeah, we should talk about that again, because you've mentioned that a few times and it always comes up at the end of a chat and we keep meaning.
Yes.
To do it. We'll do it. Listen, that was fascinating. We'll put the hoods and those bonnets back down and put those demons to bed for a while. And it was great. It was great to talk about it.
Well, yeah, you can talk about the demons, I think, when you have conquered them. Isn't that right, Woody? Like that's the great satisfaction now, that I think they appear for everyone, but you just got to keep cutting them. And now that we're finished and on the couch, it was some enjoyable days.
Yeah, sure, great days. And you can look back on it now and you can actually be a little bit more vulnerable now talking about things in the past, because you don't want to show that vulnerability at the time. And
completely.
Yeah, and it's much easier to do it kind of looking back, you know. But look, I still find that my big regret actually is, I'd like to have won more, of course. That is a regret. But my big regret was that I didn't really love every second of it. I felt as if the pressure was quite huge for a lot of it. I wish I enjoyed it a little bit more. And I did enjoy it. But actually, it is a privilege to play, and to play for a country, it's a huge privilege. And you have to accept that fact and smile. I was talking about someone the other day, and one of my favourite players I've watched for the last number of years is Shad Britz, because he looks like he's having a howl every time he goes onto the field. Like, he just looks so happy. He was at the end of his career, he was at a place where kind of everything was a freebie for him.
Yeah, but you got to remember too, I suppose, the acceleration that you gave to the whole system, and the fact that when you played in green, you were probably on a good campaign, it might be, in the early days, might be 2 out of 5 wins or 2 out of 4 wins. Ireland weren't at all used. There was no culture of winning. There was good for a one-off scalp, but you can imagine that mindset on a consistent basis. It's very, very different and nearly uncomparable to what is happening nowadays, where, you know what I mean, people are used to winning European Cups. But I think the big challenge for all of us would be to, how can we succeed at a World Cup?
Yeah. Well, we'll park that one for now. Listen, gents, that was great. Ronan, Keith, thanks so much.
Pleasure, Joe.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers, Roddy.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.